Louise Bedford here. Just before we kick off with today's show, I wanted to let you know that for 1 week only, you can get up to 84% off a selection of my most popular trading education products available through tradinggame.com.au. Make no mistake, your financial future is in your hands. So check out the audios, videos, and study courses that I have available at tradinggame.com.au. Now's your chance to develop your skills as a trader for up to 84% off, but only for the next week. Let's get on with the show.
So when I interviewed Jack Bogle, for example, 20-something years ago, founder of Vanguard, he said to me, look, the idea of indexing is simplicity itself. He said, basically, when you have a middleman, a croupier, as he put it, scraping off money from the top every time you buy something, it eats away at your returns. And most people at the time totally dismissed the innovation of index funds. I mean, he at first, I think he raised something like $11 million for the first index fund. And people dismissed it as basically an exercise in mediocrity. How could you want to get the market return? It's so mediocre. And that observation of his, that lowering your expenses gives you a tremendous advantage, has led to Vanguard now managing more than $7 trillion.
Hi, this is Caroline Stephen, and this is Talking Trading. What do the world's super investors have in common? Today, our guest, former Time magazine journalist William Green, continues to fascinate us with more stories from the world's super investors and how they win in both the markets and life. What did Jack Bogle say when he started Vanguard Index Fund? Holocaust survivor Arnold Vandenberg, who grew up on the same street as Anne Frank, what principles guide his life and define his success? Again, this interview is longer than normal Talking Trading episodes because of the content of William's stories. William's brilliant book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, is available on Amazon, and you can find William's contact details in the show notes. He loves hearing from readers. But first, this is your last chance to get involved with priority notification for the 2022 Trading Game Mentor Program. So if you want some magic, let's hear Louise Bedford about priority notification, and then we'll go to William Green.
Go to tradinggame.com.au/priority so that you can register to get priority notification about the Trading Game Mentor Program. Plus, you'll receive a whole heap of free trading training. I know you're going to love it. tradinggame.com.au/priority.
And here is the second part of former Time magazine journalist interview William Green, where we pick up on the question of simplicity in the markets. So talk about simplicity being the ultimate sophistication. You say that Warren Buffett is the grandmaster himself of simplification. How important is simplification in investing?
I think it's hugely important in investing and in life. And really, it was Joel Greenblatt who made me understand this. And Greenblatt, for people who don't know, has one of the greatest records of any hedge fund manager. He famously made 40% a year for 20 years, which this astonishing feat means you turn $1 million into $836 million. Incredible thing. And yet, when I asked Joel, what's the secret? He said, well, it all comes down to this. He said, you value a business and you buy it for much less than it's worth. And he said, that's it. That's the essence of what he does. And so part of what happened with Joel is that he's taught for many years at Columbia Business School, which meant that he had to keep explaining what it was that he'd figured out. And he's also written these extraordinary books, which also forced him to distill what he believed. And so there was something about that process of distillation as a teacher and as a writer that made him gradually realize, that's what I do. And so he was able to distill the essence of the game to valuing a business and buying it for less than it's worth, which is essentially what Buffett and Ben Graham had talked about as well. It's what all of these guys are saying is that this goes back to Ben Graham, right? It's that the market is kind of bipolar. And so it has these mood swings. And so it's not pricing companies in a necessarily accurate way. Some, for the most part, maybe, yes, like the market is pretty efficient. But particularly at extremes, suddenly people will become very greedy and they all love, you know, Tesla, or suddenly they're all very fearful and they all hate Alibaba. And so as the spear fisherman, you're just kind of waiting for these moments where there are these tremendous mispricings, and then you take advantage of it. So what Joel Greenblatt said to me is, if you have this simple understanding that what you're trying to do is value a business and buy it for less than it's worth, he said it gives you this tremendous context to understand what's important and what isn't important. So he said, for example, if I own a supermarket company in the Midwest of America, and there's a Greek sovereign debt crisis, and the papers are just full of talk that this is going to trigger economic contagion throughout Europe, he's like, I don't give a damn. He's like, why does it matter to me? My supermarket in the Midwest is just fine. And so he said, what you realize when you start to understand that you can simplify the game to that extent is that most people are engaged really in fruitless nonsense. And so he said, you start to discover that 99% of what most people are thinking about in terms of the markets is actually, as he put it, silly. So if you think about the amount of time that people spend reading the latest news headlines or worrying about what inflation is going to do, they're not really focused on the key point, which is it cheap? Is this company cheap? And so there are different paths up the mountain. There are a lot of different ways to invest. But for someone like Joel Greenblatt, that simple understanding, is it cheap, becomes incredibly helpful. And what's fascinating to me is that for pretty much all of the great investors, they have their own version of that type of simplicity. So when I interviewed Jack Bogle, for example, 20-something years ago, founder of Vanguard, he said to me, look, the idea of indexing is simplicity itself. He said, basically, when you have a middleman, a croupier, as he put it, scraping off money from the top every time you buy something, it eats away at your returns. And so he said, on average, actively managed funds, which have these high costs, these high expenses, these high transaction fees for their trading, higher tax bills, they have to underperform on average when compared to index funds, which are, you know, where you might be paying 0.1% or 0.014% or whatever, some minuscule amount per year. And so he said it was the simplest observation that index funds had to win. And most people at the time totally dismissed the innovation of index funds. I mean, he at first, I think he raised something like $11 million for the first index fund. And people dismissed it as basically an exercise in mediocrity. How could you want to get the market return? It's so mediocre. And that observation of his, that lowering your expenses gives you a tremendous advantage, has led to Vanguard now managing more than $7 trillion. But it was based on the most simple observation. And whether you index or not, it's a really important observation, because what you need to understand for a regular investor is, let me keep my expenses down, because those expenses really work against you. They compound over time. And there was a wonderful example from Bogle where, if I remember the math, he said, if you invested $1 million and you made 10% a year over 30 years, sorry, I think it turned out to be something like $17.5 million. And if you took off 1.5 percentage points a year for your fees, you made $6 million less over those 30 years. So that 1.5% a year in expenses cut your ultimate winnings by $6 million over 30 years. And so, it goes back to Tom Gaynor and his marginal marginal improvement in his weight of losing 1 pound a year versus me putting on 1 pound a year. That's
I'm living my investment portfolio, man.
Exactly. It's that's a it's those marginal differences become hugely important. And so that was an observation rooted in simplicity for Jack Bogle. Likewise, I think for Greenblatt, an observation rooted in simplicity. Let me buy things for less than they're worth. Yeah, so for all of us, I think it's really important to say, what do I believe? What are my principles? What's my investment approach actually based on? Why do I think it's going to work over time? And so I think it's really helpful to put down in writing what the simple principles are that you're using to guide you, partly because when things go haywire and you're living through a tumultuous period, you can look at your kind of operating manual, your rules of the game, and you can say, oh, no, well, this is why I don't sell. This is why I don't panic, because I know that I don't want to be trading in and out of the market. I know that the market predictions are, as Bill Miller said to me last week, they're just futile. It's just futile to make market predictions. So just don't do it. Just position yourself to survive an uncertain future, but don't waste your time predicting whether the market's going up or down. And so just have that sense of what you truly believe in is very clarifying.
One of the chapters I really enjoyed was Nick and Zach and how they only invested in 3 shares, Costco, Amazon, and Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah, they're extraordinary. And in a sense, when they were running a hedge fund, Nomad, they were a little more diversified. They owned about 10 stocks. But now, I mean, they have this extraordinary record. They beat the market, the MSCI International Index, the World Index. They beat by, I think, 804 percentage points over 13 years. Part of what they did is they just had this very concentrated portfolio of stocks that they understood incredibly well. And they were very, very patient owners of these stocks. And for the most part, they were all companies that were based around one business model. They basically figured out there's one business model that's better than all the rest. So again, it's a very good example of simplicity, where they said, well, if you look at a company like Costco, what they basically do is they have very, very low costs. They're very efficient. It's an incredibly well-run company. And so they would mark up their products by something like 14%. They never allowed themselves to mark up products by more than 14%. So if you're a regular supermarket, maybe it's 30% markup. So they're giving this incredible deal to their customers, which they can do because they're very efficient. And so then customers become more loyal and spend more and more. So the revenues go up. But then instead of pocketing those profits and saying, well, yeah, more gravy for us, they share those economies of scale with the customers to give them an even better deal. And so it's an act of deferred gratification in a sense. They keep giving a better and better deal to their customer. And so the customer keeps spending more and more money. And so what Nick and Zach realized is that this was the embodiment of what they call scale economies shared. So it's not just, yeah, you have scale economies, so you become richer and richer. It's you share the benefits of that scale. And the beauty of that is that instead of becoming kind of overburdened by your size, when they become very big, they get kind of slow and sluggish. But instead of that, because they use that scale to give better and better deals to their customers, their growth actually, their size actually became an advantage. And so then when Nick and Zach saw Amazon come along, they were like, oh, it's Costco with speed, because it's Costco on speed, sorry, because they could basically say, well, look, here's a company that keeps deferring its own profits. And so Wall Street kept saying, well, how come they're not making money? It's unprofitable. But what Amazon was actually doing was saying, no, we have enormous revenues and we're just sharing those cost benefits to give better and better deals to our customers, to deliver stuff faster and faster, subsidizing that postage and stuff so that it's just an incredible deal. And so basically Nick and Zach bought in at something like $30 a share. And so when I spoke to Zach recently, his personal portfolio is basically 70% in Amazon because he's never sold a stock, a share of Amazon. And so really, again, it's this simple understanding that this business model is incredibly powerful, and then a willingness to say, well, as Nick said, everything else seems a little bit trite and stupid in comparison to this one business model. Once you realize that this one business model is better than all the rest, why wouldn't you bet big on it? And so he ended up with this three-stock portfolio, personally, nine-figure three-stock portfolio, because he's like, well, no, these companies, they have great destinations because they keep behaving really smartly, intelligently, in a long-term way, in a world where everyone else is so dominated by short-term interests. You know, Wall Street wants you to make money now. Mm-hmm. And here are companies like Berkshire, Amazon, and Costco. They're like, yeah, we'll make money in 5 years off this new product that we have. So it's a very different culture that's much more long term and much more focused on benefiting the customer. And so I think there's a kind of beautiful moral there for the rest of us, which is in a world that becomes extremely short term, the more you can focus on the long term, the more actually you have a competitive advantage. And I think that goes for an Amazon, it goes for a Costco, but it actually goes for us as well.
Very learned, William. My goodness. Let's talk about Arnold Vanderberg. Wow. What a man. What a story.
Yeah.
Holocaust survivor. I dare anyone to read this chapter and not feel profoundly moved by it. You say there's no one in the investment world that you admire more. After hearing a little bit about your background and history, I can understand why you feel a connection to Arnold even more now. What did you learn from him?
Yeah, Arnold is very remarkable. For readers who don't, listeners who don't know about Arnold, he was born on the same street as Anne Frank in Amsterdam. And so he spent the first couple of years of his life in hiding. And at a certain point, his parents decided, well, if the Nazis come in and search our house, actually their friend's house, they were staying in a kind of fake area, like there was a fake wall in the back of a closet, and they would hide behind this closet. And they said, if the Nazis come in and search and Arnold or his brother Sigmund make a noise, we'll basically all get taken to Auschwitz, and they would kill the children first, the women and children first. And so at a certain point, they decided, we need to try to get Sigmund and Arnold out. And so they contacted the Dutch underground, and this girl who was about 17 years old, who didn't know the family, basically put her own life and her entire family's life at risk by smuggling Arnold out to the countryside, to an orphanage in the countryside. And so Arnold starts his life in basically the worst possible way. His brother Sigmund is put on a farm with this other couple, the childless couple who raised him during the Holocaust. So he's separated from his brother, who he loved. He's separated from his parents. So for years, he thought that his parents had sent him away because his mother didn't want him. They didn't realize that it was because, you know, they were trying to save his life. And by the age of about six, basically, because he was living in this orphanage where there was almost no food, he couldn't really walk. He was just sort of shuffling along on his knees. And when his parents did go to Auschwitz, but actually survived miraculously. And when they came to pick him up at the age of six, he didn't recognize them. And he said, I didn't even care. I would have gone with anyone. I just wanted to get out of that place. And his father was literally scared to pick him up because he was just skin and bones. And Arnold said to me, if I'd been there another 6 months, I would have died. And so he started in the worst possible way. And when he moved to Los Angeles, to a very rough area of Los Angeles, and was beaten up on his first day of school because his mother dressed him in lederhosen and long socks. And so, you know, you can imagine this poor guy. I laughed when he told me this, and then felt really guilty. But this image of this poor boy being sent to this really tough school in East Los Angeles wearing lederhosen.
Lederhosen,
you know, like, it's like you were in The Sound of Music, you know, like being dressed in The Sound of Music while going to the hood. And so he had a terrible time at high school, barely made it through high school, never went to college. And one day heard his mother talking to a psychologist, and they were basically worried about why he was doing so badly at school. And the psychologist said, well, maybe he has brain damage from being so malnourished as a child during the Holocaust. So he grew up with this idea that he was incredibly stupid. He was a tough kid. He was always in fights. And so part of why I'm so fascinated by Arnold is that having been dealt the worst possible hand, he transformed himself into this incredibly successful investor and businessman running this very successful firm, but also into this incredibly successful human being. And so as I write at some length, after the Holocaust, he was full of rage, and his first wife left him, and he was full of rage at her, and he was full of rage at his parents. I mean, his father used to beat him up as well until, you know, finally at a certain point, Arnold punched him back. And I remember Arnold saying to me, his father was sort of sitting in their living room with his head in his hands, just kind of crying. It was like, I can't believe my own son would hit me. And he's like, you know, not only did I hit you, but next time I'm going to hit you first. And so it was this, you know, he had to be tough to survive. And so, you know, full of rage, full of anger, no self-confidence at all. And then started to take control over his inner landscape and transform himself internally, became obsessed, curiously, with self-hypnosis, and started to rewire his brain, started to rewire the way he spoke to himself. So he would say to himself over and over again, for example, I'm a loving person. And so over time, he actually transformed himself. He transformed the way he thought. And as he did that, he also really transformed his life and became incredibly successful. And one of the people who really helped him to become incredibly successful was a psychiatrist called Dr. Rameljack, who he talked to about that girl who saved his life, the 17-year-old. And he said to him, I don't understand. Why would she risk her life? This had tormented him for years. He's like, I don't understand why she would risk her life and why her father would have allowed her to risk her life to save a total stranger. And his therapist said, well, it's simple. And he's like, it is, tell me why. And he said, well, for some people, their life is more important than their principles. And for other people, their principles are more important than their life. And so Arnold said, I need to operate in a way that's worthy of the people who saved my life. And so I need to have a principle-driven life. And so he became this very ethical, very decent, very, very philanthropic, very loving, very kind bloke. And so for me, there's something kind of triumphant about this as a story of personal transformation. And so, you know, I tell the reader a little bit about how he became a successful investor. But what I'm really interested in is how he became such a successful human being. And part of the reason for that is that I'm trying to say, well, look, when you study the great investors, you see actually that none of them had a straight upward trajectory. They all had difficulties. They all had times in their life where they went through the ringer. And when you see someone like Arnold turn everything around, having been dealt the worst possible hand, you think, well, yeah, maybe I can do it too. Like maybe actually when I'm sort of depressed and melancholy, or I feel kind of listless, or I feel like I've failed at something, or I'm going in the wrong direction, like, well, I still got a better hand than Arnold. I mean, so maybe I should focus on my inner landscape. Maybe I should focus on changing the way I think, on the way I talk to myself, on sharing more with other people. And that was one of the things I was very inspired by with Arnold, is I would see the incredible joy that he took in helping other people. I mean, Arnold, as I mentioned before, he's the one who hypnotized me to change the way I spoke to myself. And multiple times since writing the book, he's called me to see how I'm doing, to see if he can help in different ways. We're constantly sending each other books. And you see the way that his kindness and his desire to share has infused his life with these very warm, loving relationships. And so he has this son, for example, who's the president of his company. And you just see the love that the father and the son have for each other. And so I see stuff like that. I see the warmth of the relationships. I've spoken to Arnold's wife as well, Eileen, who's extraordinary. And, you know, they're about to celebrate their 50th anniversary. And there's just something really moving about it. And so when I look at them, I think that's a successful life, and it changes my view of what a successful and abundant life is. And so I'm trying to say to people in the book, here's how you become rich. Here's how you become financially secure. But don't lose sight of what actually constitutes a truly successful and abundant life. And when you look at Arnold, it gives you a sense of what that is. And so that's why I write about him in the epilogue. And that's why he's the person I end the book with, because I want to, money is important. I mean, when we talked at the start and I was talking about my childhood fantasies of making money gambling and becoming rich and independent and not having to work for people I didn't like, I still believe that. I still think it's really important to be financially independent, secure, not to have to worry about paying your bills. I don't diminish the importance of money, but if you're rational about these things, if you're sensible about it and you're thoughtful about it, you have to see that relationships matter more, and that any abundant life actually has to have deeply fulfilling relationships. It has to have some degree of sharing. And you see that with people like Arnold. You see that the reason he's so joyful is partly because he loves what he does and he enjoys his work and he's found something he's good at, but partly that he's just got great relationships with people that he loves, high quality people surrounding him who want to be with someone who's a very high quality individual. And he's constantly looking to share and help. And so this is one of the great paradoxical secrets of life, right? It's when you're so focused on yourself, on your own needs, there's something kind of stunted about it. It's not a joyful way to live. And when you start to focus on lifting up other people, paradoxically, you end up becoming more joyful yourself. And so when I see someone like Arnold, it makes me think, oh yeah, I need to focus more on building good relationships and on sharing more and trying to be kinder and trying to be more loving and more sharing. And that can sound kind of hokey and pious and self-righteous, but I think what I like is the fact that when you see these great investors, they're so brutally pragmatic. And so they're just really rational people who are like, well, this makes for a happy life and this makes for an unhappy life. So what am I going to choose? And so for me, that's what I'm kind of trying to lay out for people is this is intelligent behavior that you're seeing from people like Arnold.
I think, look, the last two questions I have, you've answered. I don't think I need to ask you any more final words about the book.
I guess one thing I would say is it's a little bit of a buffet. There are a lot of different ideas in there that I think are quite powerful, not because I'm such a wise and evolved human being, but because I'm getting to interview people who are very wise, very smart, very thoughtful. And what I would say is, when you find an idea in the book that resonates with you, go big on it. Because when I see the success of people like Charlie Munger, Monish Pabrai, it all goes back to something that Munger said, which is take a simple idea, take a good idea, and take it seriously. And so when you find something in the book that you're like, wow, this guy, Tom Kane, figured out something really interesting about the compounding of good habits, or Monish Pabrai figured out something really important about the benefits of being truthful, or the benefits of what he calls cloning, where he's basically taking the smartest people on earth, and he's looking at what they figured out already instead of trying to reinvent the wheel. And so he's just shamelessly cloning all of these good ideas that he's figured out from other people. So when you find these good ideas like cloning or being more truthful or compounding good habits, go big on it because it's to some degree, it's the fanaticism of these great investors that makes them so extraordinary. It's when they find something good, they don't just dip their toes in the water and say, oh yeah, that's a nice idea, and then move on. And so I think that's how I would encourage people to read the book. It's not about finishing the book and having this general sense of like, oh yeah, I should be more rational. It's find a few things that you're like, no, I'm going to internalize this. I'm going to actually act on this, because you don't need to act on all of these things, but they're such powerful ideas that are time-tested by these extraordinarily successful people. And so just take a few things and make them really a part of your life. And these things have helped me a great deal. So I'm sort of a guinea pig for these ideas. So I can tell you they're helpful.
William, where do people go to buy a copy of Richer, Wiser, Happier?
Thank you for asking. It's always available at a good price on Amazon or any local bookstore. And also, if you want to visit my website, which is williamgreenwrites.com, there are always interviews and stuff posted on there that you can listen to. And you're welcome to contact me on LinkedIn or Twitter, where I think I'm WilliamGreen72. And feel free to write to me. I'm always happy to hear from people. And I actually do try to reply. So I'm not always great at it, but I love hearing from people who've read the book and found it helpful, and very, very happy to keep in touch with you. I get messages all the time on LinkedIn, on Twitter, and on my website. And it's lovely, actually. I think some writers find the whole process of writing a book kind of, you know, the writing is kind of great and then they're done. And dealing with readers is kind of burdensome. I actually love the part of dealing with readers. It's like, it's really lovely to see the book having an impact on people's lives and to hear what's helped them, what's touched them. And
thanks for coming on to Talking Trading.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's all for today's show. I hope you loved William's stories on the world's super investors. I thought they were amazing. Next week, we come back down to earth as we talk to lawyer Jackie Broman on estate planning and its importance. So for a very legal episode next week, take care, stay safe, tune in. I'll see you next time. As always, if you like this show, please be sure to tell a friend. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcast and make sure you give us a big fat 5-star review. You'll also notice that Talking Trading doesn't use sponsors and barely advertises. This is because Chris Tate and Louise Bedford fund this show from tradinggame.com.au. So until next week, happy trading. The views represented on Talking Trading are general in nature and do not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Before acting on any of the information, consider its appropriateness in regards to your own situation.